Welcome back to Vocal Point. This is Jerry Newcomb, and right now we're going to talk with Wesley Smith. We spoke with him briefly, but not long enough. He's written a new book called The War on Humans, and this is published by Discovery Institute Press. Wesley, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much.
All right, good. First of all, for those not familiar with it, obviously there are some positive goals to the environmental movement, but what has happened recently?
Yeah, and of course, the purpose of my book, War on Humans, is not to say there shouldn't be good environmental practices. In fact, I've been on a few shows where people have basically called and said, well, aren't we supposed to take good care of the planet? Of course we are. And that just shows you, I think, how successful the radical takeover has been of environmentalism. So if you are calling for common sense, a proper balancing between human thriving and human prosperity and proper practices in terms of keeping the environment clean and so forth, they accuse you of wanting to poison the water and make the planet cook in its own juices. In fact, what we need is a pro-human environmentalism that looks kindly upon human prosperity, because that is what is required to have good environmental practices. If people are desperate, if people are in a survival mode, they're not going to care about the environment. And if you look at the world today, the countries that have the poorest environmental records are going to be the poorer countries. You look at the Soviet Union when it was around, and today China. What has happened is that, to answer your broader question, is that the healthy approach to environmentalism, conservation for future generations, protecting endangered species, protecting wilderness areas, remediating, that is, cleaning up areas that have been not treated well in the past. Some of that's still there, and we should support it, but it is being subsumed by an anti-humanism that centers on humans as the enemy of the planet. Mm-hmm. And so it identifies humans as the cancers on the earth, this kind of thing. We hear that over and over. And if you identify yourself as an affliction, that's not only bad in terms of your self-image, but how are you going to follow? How are the most people going to follow a green flag that says, follow us, you're a cancer? It's just not going to happen.
Well, there are approximately, according to your book, about 8 to 9 billion people in the world. But according to so many of these different specialists or experts within the environmentalist movement that you quote, they say that the world should be less than 1 billion people. So
yeah,
what does that do
this,
for the other 7
well,
billion or so?
That raises a lot of issues. This kind of idea of radical anti-humanism, meaning that it's not only that we have the right to control our family size, but that we should radically reduce the number of us, got its modern start in the deep ecology movement in the 70s, which called for a human population under 1 billion, and that was pretty well poo-pooed. But that idea has really entered mainstream thinking. Sir David Attenborough, I mean, he is as mainstream as you get in environmentalism. He's the fellow who's done all of those wonderful wildlife documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
He recently came out in the last couple of years. He's gone on this anti-human binge. He calls us, and these are his words, a plague on the planet. He says that we need to have a depopulation. Now, he doesn't say to under a billion, but he's still talking about reducing the numbers of people. What would that take? Let's take a look at the one-child policy in China. Now, Attenborough has applauded the one-child policy. What is involved in the one-child policy?
Forced abortion.
As I'm sure your listeners know, if a Chinese woman has a second child, mm-hmm. often she is dragged, kicking and screaming, into an operation room, and that child is ripped from her womb, forced abortion.
Mm-hmm.
In many of the rural areas, you've had female infanticide, because if you can only have one child,
mm-hmm.
many rural families where they have to depend on their children to support them in their old age want boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that has led to a tremendous
imbalance.
Imbalance,
yep.
Yeah, thank you. Imbalance males to females in Chinese society, tens of millions of more males than females, which is leading to great social dislocation, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
So this kind of tyranny has received support not only from David Attenborough, but among many mainstream environmental activists, particularly those in the global warming movement, that see a reduction of human population as essential to, quote, save the planet. This is very, very disturbing. And when you think about the China's one-child policy, it has not reduced the number of Chinese. All of that tyranny, all of that oppression, and we haven't even described it all. There's a eugenics approach, too. All of that authoritarian force has only slowed the rate of growth. If you really wanted to reduce the number of human beings, it's just these handing out birth control isn't going to do it. It would take a tyrannous, bloody approach that Sir David Attenborough would never countenance, but there are others who might. Mm. And then you hear about many of these in the academy who are kind of hoping for a worldwide pandemic, that some virus will come along and take out 80% of us. Can you imagine yearning? And I describe it very clearly with quotes in both the War on Humans movie and in the book. Mm-hmm. And they're teaching our kids in the universities. They're teaching our kids that they are vermin, that they are parasites. Popular culture has a lot to do with this, too. I don't know about you, but did you ever see the original The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Yeah, I think so, with a robot or something. Yeah.
But yes, Michael Rennie, a great old kind of dignified movie star from the early 50s. This movie came out in 51. When I was a kid, I used to be in those space movie matinees that I used to love to go to with my friends, where we'd kind of binge on three or four movies, right? And one of them, my favorites, was The Day the Earth Stood Still. And the story is Michael Rennie is an alien. He comes with a killer robot, Gort, lands a flying saucer on the mall in Washington, D.C. And, of course, the Army turns out. And he has come here on a mission from the great space community. It kind of predates Star Trek, you know. Mm-hmm. And the space community has noticed that human beings have become very technological, that we have nuclear power, that we are beginning to test rockets. Remember, this is back in the 50s. And they're worried. They're worried because of our warlike ways. So Michael Rennie, who plays Klaatu comes to Earth to save us from ourselves. And in the course of the show, a panicked soldier shoots him. He gets taken to hospital. Gort gets the killer robot is upset because Klaatu has been shot. He escapes with Patricia Neal in the original and a child, and he learns about humanity and that our good side. And then he leaves and he says, "You have to take care of yourself so that you can join us in space. And if you don't, then we're not going to let you come out into space because we won't let war out there." The remake in 2008, starring Keanu Reeves, mm-hmm. is the same story, but there's a crucial difference that I think shows how the dark nihilism that has entered into our popular culture about environmentalism. Klaatu doesn't come down to save humankind from itself. Mm-hmm. Klaatu comes down to Earth to kill each and every human being on the planet to save the Earth. Mm-hmm. That's his mission.
Yeah, in fact, right here, I've got your book open, or your manuscript, and it says, Klaatu, "The planet is dying. The human race is killing it." Then another character says, "Oh, so you've come here to help us." "No, I didn't. You just said you came to save us." "I said I came to save the Earth," says Klaatu.
That's right. And the way to save the Earth, and this is A-list Hollywood, is to kill every human being on the planet.
Beginning with the producers? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's a, don't get logical. There's a strong implication in the movie that the Earth is a living entity, because all the space aliens come on the spaceships are not flying saucers. They're mini Earths. They're blue globes with clouds, almost like they have ecosystems. And Klaatu at one point says, the human says, "This is our Earth." And he says, "What do you mean it's yours?" So the Earth is a living entity, at least by strong implication in this movie. There's a Noah's Ark scene where all of these globes come and they remove all the two by two, like in the Noah's Ark story, yeah. they remove all the animals from the Earth in preparation for the Great Obliteration. And as soon as there's the Great Obliteration, they'll put the animals back on the planet so that the Earth can basically thrive without the nasty parasite humans threatening it. And the way the movie ends is, and here's a spoiler alert, but the way the movie ends is Klaatu is convinced that there are some benefits to humankind because of Mozart music. And he decides, he takes pity on us as the great obliteration is beginning. Gort, the robot, turns into a nanoswarm, and it's destroying everything in its path. And Klaatu says, all right, I will not kill every human being on the planet, but there's going to be a price. And he takes off in his ship, and he emits a pulse, and the Earth becomes totally non-technological. The electricity ends, the oil drilling ends, all of the things that they have pictures that are supposedly wrong.
In order to save us.
To save, yeah. So he unstated in this quote happy ending is there will be billions of people on the Earth dying of starvation and disease because we have lost technology. Now, so what we have become in this green, the green elites, the people who are driving the movement, the people who are trying to convince our children that they're going to die, I mean, scaring kids, literally, is anti-prosperity, anti-thriving, anti-human, and it's very dangerous. So that you now see, back to actual advocacy, if your listeners will do some research on Google, or take a look at my Human Exceptionalism blog at National Review Online, they will see there is now advocacy for what is being called degrowth. In other words, shrinking the economy to save the Earth. You think today's economy is fun? You shrink it further, and you think about the consequences that will come from a poor nation, the consequences to our lives, the consequences to our children's futures, the consequences to human freedom, because when there's not prosperity, freedom becomes much harder to maintain. It's a very, very unfortunate turn in environmentalism. And I wrote this book and was part of the movie, The War on Humans, not because I don't like environmentalism, but because I do. I am an environmentalist, as I'm sure you are, properly understood. I am certainly not an anti-human environmentalist. Pro-human environmentalism is good for the Earth, and it's good for human beings.
Hmm. All right, we're talking right now with Wesley Smith, and he's written a book called The War on Humans. Go ahead and give the website for the movie that you've made that is a companion to the book.
Thanks. Yeah, and it's also, you can, the book is an ebook, and it's available on Nook, Kindle, and Apple, and both can be linked at waronhumans.com, waronhumans.com. The documentary is on YouTube. It's about 30 minutes. It's obviously free, and the ebook is very inexpensive, $1.99, which we did so people could download it, and we want people to get the information. And you know, Jerry, this is the first ebook I've written. All my other books have been hardcover. And one of the reasons I wrote
Saving Trees. Oh, I'm sorry.
I still like writing hardcover books, but this book, I thought, you know, I'm not focusing on actual policy proposals. I just wanted to focus on one thing, and it's over 8 chapters and 100 pages, and that is how this movement has shifted its emphasis and its activism, because our ideas have consequences.
Yeah.
If we think we're a cancer, if we think we're just another animal in the forest, then that's how we'll act.
That's true.
And I thought that the worst, the biggest benefit or the biggest ally, let me put it that way, to the anti-humanism is that most people don't believe it's real. Many of your listeners are going to be listening because I've gotten these phone calls on other shows, and they'll say, oh, yeah, sure, some radicals, some nuts will say this thing, but that's not what most people in environmentalism think. And so they'll say, they're just being nuts, it can't happen here. Well, anybody who thinks it can't happen here hasn't been awake for the last 50 years. The most of the people, of course, would reject this kind of thinking. But those who are some of the most powerful among us, the people who are in the universities, the people who are in the international bureaucracy, this is a huge United Nations agenda item.
Wow.
Because it not only goes along with their ideological beliefs, but it gives them power. When you are creating a technocracy, which is what the global warming activists are trying to do, an international technocracy to control the saving of the Earth, you're giving a lot of power to unelected people. And that you see a lot of that going on. And it's also become caught up in I call the green movement has turned brown. Why? Well, you mix red with green and you get brown because there's a lot of anti-capitalism, anti-free market activism going on now. We've already talked about the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still as a form of propaganda, if you will, in the popular culture. And you see that in the popular culture all over the place. I'm even told that the new Noah picture, and I don't know if this is true, but in the Bible, as you know, the people are killed in the flood because they've become immoral.
Mm-hmm.
According to what I've read, and I haven't seen it, the people in the Noah movie are killed because of overpopulation and to save the earth.
Oh.
Now, if I may be wrong about that, that's a hearsay statement from something I've read a couple of places, and I know that the producers are furiously, what would we say, re-editing.
Right, right.
So I don't know if that's true, but I've seen that story in more than one place, and if it is true,
yes,
that they changed the reason for the flood along the lines of what we're discussing, what does that tell us? And they're trying to, and by the way, the faith community is beginning to fall for a lot of this stuff because they say, well, shouldn't we be stewards of the earth? Well, of course. But if you're a steward of the earth, who are you a fiduciary of? You are a fiduciary of God. You are doing the work for God.
Right.
And what this new movement seeks to do is you become a fiduciary of nature, the living earth, and it becomes a neo-earth religion. That's a distinction with a difference.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Now, there's one name that keeps coming up in your book, and I think it's worth taking the time to just set back and explain who was Malthus and what does Malthusian mean?
Malthus was a fellow from a few centuries ago who I think is the first one that I'm aware of who came up with the idea that there are too many people on the earth,
mm-hmm.
and we have to dramatically limit the number of people if we're going to be able to sustain ourselves on this planet. Now, of course, since then, that's been proven to be untrue because of technology. Now, if we were an on-technological species like the Day the Earth Stood Still wanted to make us, we could not support the number of people who live on the earth today because of we need the technology. But with technology, we certainly can. But this Malthusianism, as it's called, you've seen it. You've seen the idea really taking off again in the 60s and 70s. Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, some of the other Earhart's books on population, they've all been proven wrong, but that idea keeps pushing forward as anti-humanism. And let me show you how these ideas are even getting into government policy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a town called King Cove up in Alaska, and King Cove is a fishing village, and it's near a federal preserve for animals. I'm very remote, and as you know, Jerry, in Alaska, the only way to get from A to B is basically to fly. And King Cove has a small airport, but it's not an all-weather airport, and the airport can't be used at least half the year, maybe even 200 days a year. Excuse me. So when there's a medical emergency in King Cove, they have a health clinic, of course, but if somebody needs surgery or mm-hmm. there's a life-threatening fall or something of that sort, the way they have to help their people is to evacuate them from King Cove to a hospital.
But only in good weather.
But they can only do that in good weather, right. So about 25 or 30 miles from King Cove is another town that has an all-weather airport. And so the people of King Cove for years have been saying to the federal government, all we want to do is cut a one-lane gravel road through the preserve so that in time of medical emergency, we can evacuate our ill to this all-weather airport, and then they can go get the help they need. Not having that has cost, they said, 19 lives over the last several years because people couldn't get out. They've even offered a land swap where for the right to cut this one-lane gravel road, which isn't going to cause that much disruption in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres, right? They've offered, like, I think it was 340 acres to give to the preserve to make up for this one road they've cut through. And the federal government said no. In fact, Sally Jewell, who is our Secretary of Interior, went up to King Cove, and this is what she said. I've listened to your stories, and their stories were about people dying because they couldn't be evacuated. I've listened to your stories. Now I have to listen to the animals. Can you imagine? So the federal government, and these are Aleuts for the most part, the federal government is telling indigenous people of Alaska that they have to, in order to live in King Cove where they, you know, where their homes are, they have to risk being dying because they can't get medically evacuated because the government won't let them build a simple gravel road, even though they receive hundreds of acres in compensation for the animals to roam free. I just find it despicable.
We're talking right now with Wesley Smith, author of the book The War on Humans, thewaronhumans.com for more information. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And it has links to the e-books and to the movie.
Can you comment on global warming?
Yeah, you know, I'm not, this book doesn't take a position, yes or no, on it, but I do disclose what I think. I think that the global warming is not completely a fraud. That is, there are people who are saying, oh, this is all fraud, it's all made up. I don't think so. We've certainly seen that the planet has warmed over the last 100 years.
Now, by this, do you mean man-made global warming?
No, I'm just talking about global warming
in period. Okay.
Yeah, so there has been a warming, and in the history of the planet, the planet warms and it cools. Now, has there been some man-made contributions? I think it's possible. So I don't think it's a fraud to say, oh, men have nothing to do with it, man has nothing to do with it. I certainly don't think it's a fact, because there has been no statistically significant global warming for 17 years. And that defies all of the supposed models that projected that the increase in CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere would lead to a direct correlation of rising temperature. What I find stunning and anti-scientific is when the expectations from the scientific hypothesis of man-made global warming didn't come true, proper science is you go back and relook at your hypothesis, right?
Right.
And say, what did we do right or what did we do wrong? But they mostly haven't done that. Mostly what they've done is try to find excuses. I've seen excuses such as, well, there's a lot of pollution in China. That's cooling the planet. Meanwhile, they're yelling that China is burning coal and warming the planet. You've seen excuses, well, high winds or the deep ocean is capturing the carbon or you know, on and on and on. The one thing I do object to is what I call global warming hysteria. That is to get people into an anti-human frenzy, if you will, or to support this kind of anti-human thinking, you have to scare people. So you've seen all of these scare headlines like Himalayan glaciers will disappear by 2035. Remember that? That was put out by the IPCC, which is the United Nations, wrong. That was a mistake, and they knew it was a mistake, but they didn't correct it until after the Copenhagen conference. The polar bears are going to drown. Well, they're actually increasing in number. Global warming is melting the snows of Kilimanjaro. These are things that have been said. No, the snows had difficulty because of deforestation, but they're actually, my niece actually just climbed Mount Kilimanjaro.
Oh, wow.
And the snows are coming back. In England, they will not know snow. Now they're buried in snow.
Huh.
I mean, it goes on and on. You know, if it's a drought, it's global warming. If it's a flood, it's global warming. They've actually made fools of themselves with all of these various predictions. Eat bugs to fight global warming. You can't have dogs. On and on. So I talk about that, write about that in the book, all this various hysteria. Then I get into how, whether there is a human element or not, this idea of pushing anti-humanism, pushing authoritarianism in the name of saving the planet from global warming is very disturbing. So the book has two chapters on that issue in it.
Well, I've got one part open, one of those chapters, and you actually quote a liberal publication, the Mother Nature Network, and they say this, quote, Genghis Khan's Mongol invasion in the 13th and 14th century was so vast that it must have been the first instance in history of a single culture causing man-made climate change. And they actually laud what Genghis Khan did in killing all those millions of people.
Genghis Khan killed millions of people, and that made that was a good thing.
For
that
the planet.
That tells you what gets so scary. That's why this anti-humanism gets so scary. It becomes very easy to to shift into an authoritarianism and a deadly genocidal one. And Thomas Friedman, he's as mainstream as you get, the New York Times columnist.
Yeah.
He's been applauding China because they can make industrial decisions with the snap of a finger. None of that messy democracy, don't you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's scary. Just, I don't want to call anybody a Nazi, but we can always learn from the Nazis when they began to dehumanize people, the Jews first, and then the Gypsies, and then Slavs, and so forth. It was there onto a slippery slope, you know, into killing all the people. Oh, and of course, the Holocaust began, as most people don't know, with about 200 to 275,000 severely handicapped people that were euthanized and killed to, you know, put them out of their misery.
Right, and that wasn't the Nazis. That was the eugenicists. Doctors were not forced to kill disabled adults or children or babies. They wanted to because they thought it was a, quote, healing treatment.
Wow.
So that, and then the Nazis did use the killing of the adult disabled as a way of rehearsing for the general Holocaust in terms of gassing and so forth. Let me show
But
you
it all
how,
began with very small, you know, in a very small way. But once you start dehumanizing somebody, you know, like you're saying in this book, calling, you know, are you the part of the AIDS virus? I'm a AIDS virus, according to, you know, one of these environmentalists, Watson.
Exactly. It begins with the idea of rejecting the unique value of human life. When you reject human exceptionalism, the weak and the vulnerable are going to be the ones who get it first.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's almost, you could almost call that a law of nature. And if you look back on the history of humankind, the evils that we've perpetrated against each other have come about because of
dehumanizing
the other, whether it's based on religion or tribe or whatever.
Right.
Now it's based on humanity, on being human. In the environmental movement, that's and it's becoming increasingly mainstream. And listen to what they're teaching their kids. One of the good things about an e-book is rather than just describe something, you can link to it so people can see it for themselves.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And one of the links I have in the book is to an ad called No Pressure. It's a global warming ad aimed at children. The No Pressure ad tries to get children and others to reduce their carbon output by 10%. And the ad shows an elementary school in the UK, and the teacher is saying, oh, this is what you can do, and how many are you for it? And all the kids, you know, raise their head, yay! And then she says, how many aren't thinking they'll participate? And two kids raise their hand, and they say, well, I'm just really not convinced. And she says, oh, don't worry, no pressure. And she pushes a red button, and Jerry, they explode.
Now, that's just a joke, though. I've seen that video. Isn't that the satire?
It's not a joke. It was an actual ad in favor of global warming, fighting global warming. And the person who did the ad, I quote, in The War on Humans, defended that ad, that murderous ad, saying that if you don't agree with global warming, you deserve to die.
What?
By saying, well, global warming is killing 300,000 people a year, so what's wrong with killing a few fictional people? Well, first off, the 300,000 a year is baloney, and you do not teach children that they should be dead if they don't agree with a politically correct point of view.
That is amazing. We have less than half a minute to go, but what would you like to say? Again, Wesley Smith, The War on Humans, and give the website, but go ahead and give us a 30-second closer.
Sure. We need to promote proper environmental practices in a pro-human way that extols human virtue, the value of human life, promotes prosperity because that is the best way to have a clean environment, and does not scare children into thinking we're killing the earth.
Wow.
I write about these issues at waronhumans.com, the ebook, and if you want to follow things as they go forward, my blog on the National Review, nationalreview.com, the Human Exceptionalism blog. I'm continuing to follow these agenda issues there, plus my Twitter, which is @ForcedExit, @ForcedExit.
@Forced, F-O-R-C-E-D, exit?
Yes.
Okay. Wesley Smith, thanks so much for being with us.
I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you now. That's, again, Wesley Smith. The name of his book is The War on Humans. TheWarOnHumans.com for more information. This is Jerry Newcomb. Have a great week. God bless.